funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do boys learn what it means to be male? Even in preschool, little boys are paying close attention to what their peers say and do and how they deal with frustrations and conflicts. As my guest today discovered, by studying one group of boys as they grew from age 4 to age 6, even as they reap the social benefits of conforming to expectations of how they should behave, boys also pay an emotional price as they learn to conceal certain aspects of their personalities. Judy Y. Chu is affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University. Her new book is When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Judy, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you met this particular group of little boys that you observed when they were 4 years old in the beginning. What makes this time between 4 and 6 an interesting moment to study boys' development?
Well, it's a critical moment of transition because a lot of times that's the age when boys and girls are entering schools for the first time and they're being introduced to values or beliefs or notions that are outside the familiarity of their homes and their family culture. And so they come to, it's also at this age when they are still very open and very honest, very kind of willing to just put themselves out there and say what they think. And they're learning quickly through experience and through observation of how other kids react to them or how adults react to them, what's considered appropriate or desirable, particularly for boys. And also for girls, like as boys, what's considered appropriate and desirable. And they are gradually becoming kind of more savvy and more selective about how they choose to express themselves and engage others, what they allow themselves to reveal. So it's at this moment where you can both see their relational capabilities, and that would be what they're capable of knowing and doing in their relationships, but they're also kind of starting to rein in their, you know, starting to put limits or be more careful about what they put out there because they are seeing and experiencing that there are consequences to their behaviors.
So this is really, you're describing the last moment that they are truly just themselves as opposed to creatures that are built out of social relationships.
Obviously they are having social relationships, you know, before that age as well. You know, it's not that they're entirely confined to their homes and not interacting with other people. But this is a time when kind of the rules come in, the rules mm-hmm. about how to be one of the boys, how to be with the boys. And because they want to, you know, be popular and be accepted and fit in, those rules are becoming more important to them personally. And so it's not just, oh, their parents telling them, oh, don't do this at this moment. It's them kind of starting to take responsibilities for, if I behave this way, people will respond to me, you know, either in a good way or in a bad way, and how do I want to go forward? So it becomes a time when they do have to become more self-conscious in that sense and not just kind of putting everything out there in a very uninhibited way.
I was fascinated at how quickly you were able to identify a clear hierarchy among these boys. Can you talk about how it manifested itself?
Yeah, I mean, it was apparent during the first few, I ended at school during the first month that in September, and it was immediately apparent that there was a hierarchy among the boys. There was Mike, who was very clearly the leader of the boys. He was the biggest boy. He was also the kind of toughest boy, like the one who was going to tell people what to do, and they would kind of listen to him because he was physically intimidating because of his size and also because of his kind of tough personality. And then, you know, there were kind of the boys in the middle who were, you know, happy to kind of go along. They didn't really mind being told what to do, but sometimes they want, you know, if there's something was not what they wanted to do, they were willing to speak up about it. So they were kind of in the middle. And then the ones at the bottom who kind of were just kind of doing their own thing and weren't particularly concerned with being a part of the boy group. And so they were at the bottom of the hierarchy, but they were also in that sense more free to, for instance, play with the girls or play with girls' dolls because they weren't looking in particular for the approval of the other boys.
And you started to observe a shift in the way they related to one another about halfway through that pre-kindergarten year. Can you talk about what started to change?
Well, I think it's what I describe in my book is that I had been kind of pleasantly surprised and impressed by, in the beginning of the pre-kindergarten year, by how, like I said, how open and honest they were. They were very articulate. I hadn't expected four-year-old boys to be quite so self-reflective and able to say what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and why. They were very articulate. They were very direct about it, so there wasn't kind of this roundabout way of, oh, you know, implying what they thought. They just came right out and said it, so I never had to second-guess them. They were also very authentic, like, you know, when they were wary of me or they didn't want me around, they came right out and said it, so I didn't have to guess at what they meant. And they were also very attentive in their relationships. They were, you know, paid careful attention to each other. They seemed to understand that a good way to get people interested in them was to be interested in other people. And so they had this kind of intuitive sense about how to be with other people in a way that was conducive to bonding or connecting or developing friendships with them. And then as the year progressed, I saw them kind of beginning to shift their presence, being, again, with this kind of idea of as they're learning what's appropriate, as they're being punished for doing things that are deviant from what was expected, them kind of becoming more selective, a little bit more withdrawn, a little more constrained about what they put out there, to the point where it's, you know, they weren't saying what they thought, and it began to look like they didn't know what they thought, you know, so just kind of self-silencing or just kind of being more careful or choosing, being very careful about choosing someone they knew they could really trust to protect their secrets or to protect their, you know, any emotions that they shared with that person, instead of just kind of going out there and being wearing their hearts on their sleeves, so to speak.
And when you say, Judy, punished for, like, violating norms, they would get scolded in school if they misbehaved, but really what you're talking about is, you know, sort of censured by the group if they didn't go with what was expected of them.
That's exactly right. The boys had actually formed a club for themselves, and it was created by Mike, who, like, as I pointed out, was kind of the obvious leader of the boys. He created the Mean Team, which was a group created by the boys, for the boys, for the purpose or the express purpose of acting against the girls. And they also used this team to define themselves in opposition to the girls. So the boys were the Mean Team and the girls were the Nice Team. And in fact, the boys had explained to me at one point that originally they thought they could be the Good Team, but since the girls are nice and the girls are good, then they must, you know, by default, they had to be the Mean Team. Mike, as the leader of the Mean Team, was able to punish people with threats of exclusion if they didn't follow the rules. So, for instance, you weren't allowed to play with the girls. And one of the middle status boys, Jake, says, you know, told me in an individual meeting that he had with me, he said, I'm actually friends with all the girls. I actually like the girls. But if Mikey finds out, he'll fire me from his team, and then I won't have a team, and that would be a bummer. And so they really understood that, you know, there was this order, and there are these rules, and they had to follow them. And the thing, too, that was confusing for them is that the rules weren't always perfectly clear. So it's like, you know, Mikey could play with the girls if he actually wanted to. In fact, there was another example in my book where the girls come over and kind of join Mike in his play, but because he's the leader, he can kind of do what he wants. But the other boys knew perfectly well that if they were to try something like that, or if they were going to play with dolls or something else considered girls' toys, you know, they would likely be punished and made fun of and excluded by the boys.
So you had to be careful to distinguish yourself from the authority figures, the teachers in the preschool. How did you establish that kind of special adult relationship with them?
I used a method called the relational method, which was kind of focused on developing trusting relationships, allowing them to be comfortable with me. I showed them that I wasn't going to tell on them when I happened to observe things that were forbidden. For instance, gunplay was forbidden in the classroom, and yet the boys would, you know, design guns anyway using Lego blocks or Duplo blocks, and they'd kind of, tote them around. And if the teachers asked them what it was, they'd be like, oh, it's a dinosaur, it's an old-fashioned microscope or something. But I would kind of express an interest in what they were doing, and I'd say, oh, you know, is that a gun? And when they said, you know, shyly admitted it was, I'd say, oh, that's, you know, I didn't get angry. I didn't tell the teacher. I kind of said, oh, that's interesting. And so taking an interest in what they were doing without judging them set me apart, because the parents and the teachers were very actively anti-gun and anti-gun play. And also just if I heard them say things, or they would kind of look to see if I was going to do something. And because I didn't react in the ways that the other adults did, they eventually allowed me access to some of the more illicit play, so to speak.
You did not have children at the time that you did this research?
That's right.
Was it easier, do you think, to sort of let go and be completely non-judgmental before you were a parent?
That's a good question. I think it definitely put me in the place, and I described this to the boys, of being in a position of not knowing, where I didn't have really any assumptions about, oh, this is what they're going to do because I know, because I have a kid. It was very, I told the boys, I'm a girl. I don't know what it's like to be a boy, so I'd be looking to them to teach me what's going on and what's important for me to know if I want to understand what it's like for them. And so it definitely, in terms of it being an exploratory study, and I wanted to be really wide open to anything that they were going to tell me, it helped me to take kind of this novice approach to saying, okay, well, I really don't know what's going on. Can you let me know? And then that also helped, rationalize when I had to ask them to explain things. Oh, can you tell me this? They're like, oh, yeah, I will, because I know you don't know because you're a woman and you used to be a girl.
We talk about that because you asked them what the difference was between boys and girls and just sort of left that open-ended. What did they tell you?
I think they would start out by saying, oh, girls have long hair, boys have short hair. Or some of them, whose parents, were more explicit in explaining it, might say, a girl has a vagina and a boy has a penis. So they were more technical about it. But then even then, with the long hair, short hair thing, they would catch themselves and say, oh, but, some men or some boys have long hair. So, and what it came down to was they'd either say, oh, well, I don't know what the difference is, or they would say, oh, it was about toy preference. They would say, the boys really like guns and stuff, and the girls really like dolls and stuff. And in fact, that became a prime kind of motivator for the boys learning to really display an interest in guns, whether or not they were individually interested. I mean, some of them were individually interested in the guns, but some of them, were also interested in trains or in blocks or in drawing and other things. And the way that they showed to the other boys that they were one of the boys was through toy preference. And, so it became a problem for one of the boys who actually was interested in dolls, that he had to learn to kind of at least outwardly reject doll play, because if he wanted the boys to accept him, that wasn't going to be conducive to his bond, forming bonds with the other boys.
I realize that this study really is about the development of boys, and that's been the focus of your work, but is there reason to believe that there's a similar process going on a parallel course with the girls at this age?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's been my mentor, Carol Gilligan, actually started with looking at girls at early adolescence and looking at that as a critical period for them in terms of kind of facing heightened pressures to conform to norms of femininity or norms of feminine behavior. But the message, once kids enter schools and leave their homes and are spending more time with peers, absolutely messages about gender pressures to kind of conform to group and cultural norms definitely come in for girls as well. And so the girls would start wearing, even in the kindergarten year, the girls would wear things like girl power t-shirts and things like that. And I would ask them, what do those shirts mean? And they'd say, I have no idea, because their parents bought it for them. But there were these messages that they were internalizing as well. And the girls, too, understood that toy preference was a way to show that they were one of the girls. So when I had offered some of the toys that I was using with the boys in our meetings to one of the girls who had asked to meet with me, she said, oh, well, I don't like those toys because those toys are for boys, And I asked her, well, what kind of toys do you like? And she said, good toys, toys for girls. And so they also understand that, their behavior, the kind of behaviors and their toy preferences and the things that they say that they're interested in are all ways that they can indicate to other people, which team they're on. And if they're on the girl team or the boy team.
Judy Y. Chu is my guest. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford and author of the new book, When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Judy Y. Chu. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University. She did a 2-year study of boys between the ages of 4 and 6 to see them developing as in relationships. And she's the author of a new book called When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Judy, where were these boys taking their cues for how to be boys and for what behaviors would weaken or would reinforce their acceptance in the group?
I think largely from each other, and then what they were bringing to their interactions was seen, was based on their exposure to the media, their observations of the adults in their lives or older siblings in their lives. And so for instance, one of the boys, the leader of the mean team, his parents allowed him to watch R-rated movies. And so he would come in and he would talk about these things that he had seen. And clearly he didn't completely or fully understand what was going on, but he'd kind of tell the other boys about it, and then they'd kind of ask him about it. And in you could see that Mike would work to try to further his own understanding through his conversations and interactions with the others. And so some of these messages, a lot of these messages came from the media via the boys who had who were exposed to those particular kinds of shows.
So what would they do when they sort of got on the outs? Can you talk about how they handled conflict and how they would get back and re-ingratiate themselves after they had been, you know, temporarily excluded from something?
Well, I think it's interesting because it depended on their status, mm-hmm. whether or not they could kind of withdraw, take a break, or even resist some of the rules that were going on. The boys with a higher status could, for instance, choose to opt out of what other boys were doing. Like they might go do something privately or, you know, draw on their own for a while and then come back. So if it was by choice, they could come back easily. Or if they had low status, they didn't always care or were not as concerned about their exclusion by the boys as a group, and so they also would kind of come and go, but they never held a central position in the boys. So they knew that when they were there, they were usually assigned lesser roles, and when they were outside, sometimes people didn't even notice that they weren't a part of the group. I think the boys that really struggled with it were the ones in the middle who really wanted to be a part of the group, but then sometimes also wanted to make their own decisions about what they were going to play or what they wanted to do, or even, you know, if they wanted to be friends with the girls, things like that. And what was what made it difficult for them was if they were fired from the mean team, if their exclusion was imposed by others instead of self-imposed. And so, in fact, one of the boys that I write a case study about, he talks about kind of that struggle, and he says, he says in the beginning of the pre-kindergarten year, he really, he enjoyed being a part of the mean team. He wanted to do it. That was, what he had wanted. But as the year progressed, he found that sometimes he didn't always want to do what they were doing, especially if they were hurting other people or doing things that were making other people unhappy. But what he was afraid of was that if he left the mean team, then the boys would all group together and come after him, make him a target. And so during his kindergarten year, when I came back to visit him and kind of revisited that topic with him, he said, well, actually, he did manage to break away, and it was as simple as walking away while the other boys were engaged in something. But the consequence of that decision, of kind of making his own choices, was that he didn't get to play with the other boys anymore. It was kind of like he could either be with the boys and do whatever it was they were doing and what they told you to do, or you could be by yourself. And he was largely just grateful that he could be by himself and not have them come after him. But then it's still kind of this sad, consequence of his having to play alone, because if you either have relationships or you don't. And the best you can hope for is that if you're going to stand alone, that the others won't target you and come after you.
What's really interesting about that is that that kind of exclusion, social exclusion, is the sort of thing that we associate with girls using to punish those who have somehow violated norms. We don't think of it as much with boys.
Right. I think a lot of times things like, caring about relationships or wanting to have relationships tends to be viewed as a feminine desire or even a feminine ability. Like, girls are expected to be good at relationships and to want relationships, and we don't think about that for boys. But a lot of, even as early as infant studies show that boys are also born with a fundamental capacity and a primary desire for closeness with other people, for mutual confiding relationships where they can trust somebody, where they feel respected and accepted for who they are, and that those kind of relationships are protective throughout their lifespan, that those are the things that at adolescence will protect them against, you know, psychological risks like depression or low self-esteem. It will protect them against social risks like unintended pregnancy or substance abuse, loneliness, suicidality. Those kinds of relationships are absolutely essential to their health and well-being. And yet, because it gets gendered feminine, we don't pay as much attention to them nor think to encourage those things in boys. But absolutely the theme, like the predominant theme of connection, seeking connections and kind of resisting disconnections is common for boys as well as girls.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Alexis in McKinney. Hi, Alexis.
Hi. I am listening with great interest because I have a 5-year-old son. And one of the things that bothers me about the way you're talking about this is when you use phrases like hierarchy or you talk about the social status of these children. And I recognize it's an observational study, but I know as a parent, I try to really encourage my son to be vulnerable or to have emotions that maybe girls are more permitted socially to have. So even in a study environment, when we say these things and we say, oh, this boy Mike is the one with the power, versus being able to say, oh, these children who choose not to be involved in this have the power or the seniority, it may biologically, like in the sense of social hierarchy between animals, be appropriate, but I think it's kind of unhelpful for parents trying to understand how children develop generally and how they should encourage their own children to develop.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Alexis. Do you want to respond to that, Judy?
Sure. I think that is a great point, and I would like to just clarify that I absolutely agree with what Alexis says, and that it's not that I'm encouraging a focus on hierarchy. I'm just saying that this plays out in terms of who appears to be more tough, but those boys, you know, Mike is certainly not better off because he's the leader of the boys or the boss of the main team. In fact, you'll see that a lot of his toughness comes out of a vulnerability that he feels, a fear that he has of being abandoned by the other boys, and that's why he imposes these rules that if they leave him or they abandon him, they will not only, you know, kind of incur his wrath or his resentment, but they'll lose the support of the whole team. So he's kind of upping the ante so that, you know, to try to keep people with him. But what he doesn't see is that these styles of relating that he adopts for the purpose of having connections and relating to others are actually interfering with his ability to do so. And my mentor, Carol Gilligan, who came with me on part of these observations, one of the things that we would emphasize is that the boys who actually have power or health or happiness in their future are the ones who resist those kinds of hierarchical competitive contexts, the ones who insist on, you know, what we call resistors, because they insist on connections to themselves in terms of an ability to realize a full range of thoughts and feelings and desires and to express them. And so one of the chapters that I write about, the first case study is about Jake, and he is a resistor, and his parents sound like do what Alexis describes her doing with her son, which is, you know, expressing his emotions, not feeling like he needs to be this tough guy bully in order to be powerful, but really encouraging his self-esteem and his sense of integrity and doing what he thinks is right, not going along with the group. And so even though sometimes Jake, and he's the one who said that he was actually friends with the girls, but he was worried that Mike would fire him, he doesn't give up his friendships with the girls. He resists so that in the classroom, maybe he doesn't play, but his mom would arrange for play dates with the girls. And he would, you know, he knew that he was still friends with the girls. So by being conscious and aware of the compromises that he makes in his behaviors, he's able to maintain his beliefs. And so he doesn't give that up. And that's going to serve him well, because obviously being able to express emotions and be in touch with your emotions and care about other people is going to serve him well in his relationships throughout his life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Bill in McKinney. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I had a question about race when these boys were kind of maturing, going through that age between 4 and 6. And I remember being that age and kind of having the realization that having an experience where I realized I was of one particular race, and then another person was of another race when they mentioned it to me, and it was kind of an epiphany. you know, at that age. And you know, now, you know, as an adult, I look back on it and I think, you know, is this a real memory or is this, you know, that type of thing? And I wondered if any of these boys kind of understood that they were of a different race than somebody else.
That's a great question. I think absolutely they understood that, but it wasn't in terms of the consequences, because they were still at an age where they more or less just kind of played, you know, like a pack of puppies. They were just playing with each other and wanting to be with each other, that they didn't distinguish, they didn't group by race. But it also may have to do with the fact that the group of boys was not really big enough to be, you know, there was one African-American boy, there was one Asian-American boy, and the other four boys were Caucasian-American. And so it wasn't that there were many of them in order to, for me to observe whether there were patterns in how they tended to group or behave that were based on race.
How did they protect one another when everybody was in the group? I think it was Mike who would talk about, you know, looking out for my men, which is so funny to think about from a 4 or 5 year old. But this was like something, this was one of the benefits to being in the group.
Right. I mean, I think there had to be some incentive for the boys to want to be with them. It couldn't be all scary and all threats. And there, so I point out that he was intimidating, but he was also in some ways impressive. I mean, he kind of came across, there were moments when Mike could be tender and caring, and he did actually want to be friends with these boys. It's just, again, kind of his focus on, you know, making them be his friends through trying to control them was where his, you know, the thing that was kind of self-defeating. But absolutely, he cared about them. And when he learned that Minhang, who was an Asian-American boy, was going to be leaving the next year, his mom had actually described to me that he was inconsolable. He was so upset. And he said that he wanted to go to that school with him. He didn't want to, you know, just, again, like I said, a lot of the roots of his behaviors were this incredible fear and concern about abandonment and wanting to keep the people that he cared about or that he wanted to be his friend close by. And so the fact that his friend was going to be leaving was very, very hard for him. And even when I asked him about it, he did, you know, admit that it made him very sad, and that he said, I'm sad because he's one of my men. And so, I mean, like, the boys, you know, if you think about, like, other than Mike, you know, what would be their reasons for wanting to join the mean team? So on one hand, yes, they wanted to have that boy identity, just because being a boy meant being on the mean team. When I asked the boys, what would I have to do if I wanted to be a boy? They would say, oh, well, you just joined the mean team. So it became a proxy for being one of the boys, and that was part of the appeal. But really the bigger appeal to them was they wanted the sense of belonging. They wanted to be with the boys. They wanted to feel kind of not just identify with them, but relate to them and to feel like there was this lasting bond that, you know, even though they had their ups and downs, that they would always be, you know, they would always have their friends. And so I think that what Mike offered to them was that sense of belonging and group membership and affirmation that, oh, okay, if you stay with me, then you'll have, you know, the support of all the other boys. One of the boys, Dan, even described it. He says, you know, being on the mean team, it means that, you know, Mike tells us to do things and we do it. And if we can't do it, then, you know, the other boys help us to do it. So you never have to be alone. And that was something that, you know, again, it was at the center of what they were searching for.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Doug on the line in Lakewood. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I'm curious about the impact of sibling relationships on the group hierarchy. For example, if some of the boys who had older brothers or sisters, if they were used to hanging around the older kids, so they got more respect in the hierarchy, or just generally if you observed sibling relationships impact the group hierarchy?
That's a great question. And in fact, Mike, the leader of the boys and boss of the mean team, had an older sister who he absolutely admired and looked up to, although he didn't always openly admit it. And she, you know, although they had a reasonably good relationship, there were moments where she would taunt him or not want, you know, exclude him from things that she was doing, tell him he couldn't come into her room. And his mom said that that really upset him because he wanted to be near her. But then, of course, he'd say, well, I don't really want to play with her. But he would be really mad that she had, you know, locked him out of her room or whatever. And so, and then in addition to that, apparently, I learned from Mike's mom that at their previous schooling situation, he was actually at the bottom of the hierarchy. He was the youngest one. He was the smallest one. And he felt kind of very afraid, you know, or subject to kind of what the big kids were doing and wasn't sure how he could fit in. And so he told his mom, when I go to this new school, I'm going to be a bully. I'm going to be in charge. Hmm. And he wanted to be in control. And so that definitely kind of his experience of wanting to be with his sister and feeling the pain of, you know, her rejections or just kind of, you know, disappointed when she didn't always want to play with him. And then also having come from a place where he was at the bottom of the hierarchy and, you know, similar to his sibling relationship and kind of coming into a situation where, hey, all of a sudden he has a lot of power. He's the biggest kid and he can choose and people look to him. But it's interesting because later during that pre-kindergarten year, he kind of, you know, there are stresses to being the leader also, to always being in charge. And he would kind of talk about wanting to name someone else the boss. And at the same time, he didn't want someone else telling him what to do. And so he was a little bit conflicted about that as well. And so he chose one of the lowest ranking boys and said, oh, he's actually my boss. Although he told that boy what to say. And so he was still in charge, but at least in name, the other boy could be for that week or so the official leader, just to kind of take some of the pressure off. Because the competitive environment that he created, the kind of antagonistic, you know, follow the rules or else you'll be published environment, didn't serve him well either. He had a little more leeway in terms of what he could do and express, but he also had to more or less, you know, for the most part, abide by those rules.
I love this book in part because it's a reminder that life is complicated no matter how young you might be. My guest is Judy Y. Chu. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University and author of the new book, When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. We'll take more of your calls, read your emails after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org, and you can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Judy Y. Chu, who did a study of boys between the ages of 4 and 6 to see about their social development. Her new book is called When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. And that's where we hear from E via email, who says, I was wondering if you had any comments or advice for trans men, female to male transsexuals, who were not able to socialize as males as children, but now have to navigate the world as a male. Any thoughts, Judy?
I guess to clarify the question, is she asking for the men themselves or the parents of boys who are going to grow into trans men?
I do not know the answer to that. I suppose it's for a trans man who grew up as a female and is now learning to navigate the world as a male without that background of sort of being on the mean team at age 4 to 6.
Sure. I mean, I think the central themes of this work would apply in terms of, again, just kind of helping individuals to really stay connected. I mean, it's not about, you know, imposing one list as opposed to another, like in telling boys, oh, they should be this thing instead of that. It's really about kind of helping individuals to recognize who they are and to really develop what their particular strengths and their interests and their abilities are. And so really helping boys to stay connected to themselves in terms of being aware, being critically reflective about the messages people tell them, and also just staying grounded in their self-knowledge. And then also helping boys to stay connected to other people, important relationships in their lives. And so that would apply to all boys, including boys who've become transsexual or transgendered. This idea of their close relationships are important to their healthy development, and also there's the sense of what makes them whole, what makes them feel most comfortable with themselves, who they want to, being able to be who they want to be, and knowing that there are places in the world where they feel accepted, people with whom they can trust to really accept them and validate their experiences and encourage them.
Your conversations with the parents of these boys were very poignant to me. First of all, could you talk about how the mother's sort of assessments of their sons and wishes for their sons compared with those of the father's?
Okay, sure. I think Carol Gilligan and I decided to meet with the fathers and the mothers when we noticed, first of all, this incredible, and we had been surprised to see it, this incredible tenderness and affection and closeness that the boys exhibited towards their fathers when the fathers dropped them off at school in the mornings. And so we wanted to find out how the dads were experiencing that, and how the dads, you know, as Doug had pointed out, kind of thinking back, and also Bill had said he remembered, you know, being that age, how being with their sons brings the fathers back to a time when they were experiencing the same things that their sons are experiencing now, so this transition. And so for the dads, it was very much a, you know, what do they value in their, they talked about what they value in their boys, and because they themselves experienced that kind of push away from some of the tenderness, the sensitivity, that's what they call, you know, softness, you know, kind of hardening into what society expects them to be, the losses that they felt they experienced as a result of that, what they wanted to preserve and help support in their sons. The mothers also talked about something similar, just kind of what they cherish in their boys, the closeness that they feel, especially at this age when boys can still be very close and affectionate with their moms, even though they're learning to do it less at school. So there was a difference between how the, you know, when the mothers dropped the boys off versus when the fathers did. The boys could give their dads hugs and kisses and not have to worry about the repercussions of that for the most part. And then, but with their moms, they were a little more reserved, even though when I visit the boys at home, they would be just as affectionate with their mothers in the privacy of that realm. And so the moms would talk about, you know, wanting to preserve a full range of their boys', you know, abilities, all the things that make them appealing, that make them endearing, wanting to see that carry forward and not get squashed out of them. So in that way, the mothers and dads had similar concerns, but the moms were also wondering about this kind of socially imposed, you know, separation of boys from their mothers, because boys aren't supposed to be mama's boys, they're not supposed to be sissies, or they, you know, there's this cultural concern that moms will make their boys soft or whatever. And the moms wanted to know that they felt that they were going to be different, and they wanted to know how they could maintain that closeness with their sons, which they obviously valued and didn't want to let go of.
I wonder about the influence of the broader society, because I have to imagine that this would have been a different study if you had done it 20 or 40 or certainly 60 years ago with boys of the same age.
Oh, that's very interesting. I think absolutely the notions of masculinity have intensified over the decades, and a lot of, you know, just kind of the impact of media. I mean, if you looked at 60 years ago, not every single person had a television in their home. These days, the kids, even if they don't have television, they have the internet, their messages. And in terms of just kind of the regulation of what kinds of images get put out there, I feel like it's a lot more explicit in terms of violence and sexuality, and also even our notions of masculinity. Jackson Katz, who is an anti-violence educator, points out, you know, even in dolls, like G.I. Joe dolls, and he had this side-by-side comparison of G.I. Joe dolls from the 1950s versus the 70s versus the 80s, and the size of Joe's biceps and the muscularity just reaches, you know, ridiculous proportions in the more recent years, to the point where I think in the 90s he had said that G.I. Joe's biceps, if they were human, would have been a bit larger than Mark McGuire's, which were considered quite large. And so just kind of these expectations of, you know, from the physicality of it to kind of the stoicism that men have to kind of display when they're out and about, this tough guys, which is the name of one of Jackson's videos, kind of really shows how images in the media, in movies, in TV, and how we construct masculinity have definitely changed over the years and not necessarily towards a healthier image that that is relatable and achievable for most boys and men, or even necessarily desirable in that sense. There are some images that can be very detrimental.
We have an email here from Russell in East Dallas who says, I think it's important to point out that this is a study of young developing boys in school. Could you give your thoughts on how much of this behavior is adaptation to being forced into an environment where they are surrounded only by peers of their own age?
Oh, that's interesting. I think, let's see, well, definitely the peers are a large influence, especially at this age where they're trying to figure out, you know, can they get along with other kids their age? They are also, but if they're lucky enough, as Doug mentioned, to have older siblings who are good role models, or out, you know, other age groups that they're exposed to that can model behaviors, then they're probably going to be influenced by those as well. And so, absolutely, this is a very particular, specific context that they're growing up in. And in some, at many moments, you know, when Mike would bring in stories about some R-rated movie he'd seen, in many cases, it was the blind leading the blind. And so, definitely, I mean, other people in their lives, other relationships in their lives can be a very powerful influence and a way to help them resist or kind of make sense of the messages that otherwise, you know, relying on their peers would not really be optimal in terms of giving them the best sense of what's really going on and what it means and what their options are.
As they were learning not to express every thought and not to sort of necessarily behave always in the first way that popped into their head and to socialize to the group, was their ability to express what they really thought and how they felt, that was still there, right? They were just concealing it, or was it going away in some fundamental way?
I believe it persists. I believe that their relational capabilities, their ability to realize and express a range of thoughts and feelings and to know what they think, that's definitely there. I also studied adolescent boys and saw plenty of evidence for their ability to be articulate and authentic and attentive, all those things. But like I said, they kind of learn to channel those into relationships or situations where they know they can do those things without being criticized or harshly critiqued and things like that. And so some people in the popular discourse on boys will argue that boys at these ages lose their ability to kind of be in touch with their emotions or to have relationships. They become uninterested. But I definitely do not see evidence of that at all. I see that boys' relational capabilities, which are evident during infancy, which I observed during early childhood, and I also see carry forth through adolescence, that those are not lost. Those capabilities are not lost, and they definitely persist through adolescence and beyond.
What can adults do to allow boys to sort of be themselves and yet still feel that they are part of the groups that matter to them?
I think adult relationships, or relationships with parents, or relationships with mentors, or you know, extended family members, they can provide a source of, well, first of all, the best thing they can do is to really listen to the boys. The boys can tell you what they need if they think that you're, you know, interested in hearing it. And so listening to the boys and like, trying to kind of validate what they're going through, pointing out, like, when they're struggling, that it's reasonable to struggle, that sometimes societal norms, sometimes, you know, the things that are expected of us are not always easy to deliver, and that's normal, so that the boys don't feel as though they're somehow failing if they can't do what everyone expects of them all the time. So to really validate their struggles, to support them, and again, just kind of value all the things that they are. So instead of, you know, holding up an image of masculinity to them, like, you know, this is how you be a man, this is how you, you know, gain other people's approval, that might be very limited in the range of, that it represents in terms of, because what boys learn to do is to project this image of masculinity that is very familiar to all of us in the sense that it is consistent with our stereotypes and depictions of boys. But it doesn't always fully represent, you know, all of what boys are capable of knowing and doing. And so to really foster in boys this ability to kind of acknowledge and value a range of their experiences, a range of their abilities, so that they can move forward in ways that feel more whole to them and not kind of having to, you know, separate from parts of themselves that society deems unacceptable because it's feminine and therefore seen as a weakness or liability in boys.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Yes. In this age of Facebook egocentrism, I wonder how sociopathic tendencies are countered either within the group or if the boy is rejected or withdraws from the group. The roles, the rules of behavior, whether from parents' philosophy or church or worst of all, the media. How did she notice that?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand the question exactly, but you said that in this age of Facebook egocentrism, you're wondering about sociopathic tendencies and how the, it's a question how the boys learn to be kind of not...
Not sociopathic. Maybe he was thinking more about narcissism, and maybe that would be easier to address, sort of a self-centeredness. Can we shift the question that way?
Okay. So looking at how they learned to be so... Well, I think when, you know, in contrast to the previous question about what adults can do, when they don't have relationships that tell them, you know, it's okay to, you know, to be who you are, it's okay to kind of struggle with some of the things that society is expecting of you, then, you know... If they feel compelled to align with, you know, societal norms of masculinity, and they feel compelled to kind of distort themselves in order to accommodate at whatever cost, then there's a disconnection, and that can lead to, you know, disconnections from others, which would be conducive to that egocentrism that John describes. Like, you know, who cares what other people think? No one's going to understand me. I, you know, all I have is myself. And they withdraw, and they give up on this idea that that they could actually feel joined and understood by someone else, or accepted and genuinely liked. And so they said, "Oh, who needs them anyway?" And they withdraw into themselves. And also, they can also become disconnected from themselves, because if society is telling them that parts of themselves are not valued or valid, then they can also discount those things in themselves and become kind of dysfunctional in that way. And so. Again, kind of the emphasis is on helping boys to, you know, stay with what they know and or return to what they know, because they start out with these, you know, abilities to kind of, you know, preserve their integrity, to work, you know, to operate in the world and express themselves and engage others in ways that are conducive to kind of their health and their happiness and their at least their relational success, their ability to have strong, positive relationships. And so helping them to stay with that and to nurture those qualities, instead of shutting themselves off both to themselves and to other people.
They've got so much growing to do between 6 and the end of childhood. How predictive is their success at this age of their ability to maintain strong relationships throughout a lifetime?
I think that one of the ways to look at it is that, I mean, I feel for one thing I want to emphasize again is the concept of resistance, that there is a natural, healthy resistance against feeling imposed upon. So I usually don't like to emphasize that, oh, all masculine norms are bad or detrimental, because there are certainly things that are appropriate at certain times, like the emphasis on independence or being, you know, self-sufficient is not inherently problematic. What's problematic is when boys feel like they can't be those things and they feel like they fall short, they feel shame because they can't meet those images, that starts to play in, you know, can lead to kind of the cost and the harms of conforming. But in terms of early childhood, if they start to transition at this moment and they start to, you know, socialize themselves or to be socialized in ways that involve or result in disconnections, then it is the first in a series of disconnections that can kind of become cumulative. But they are resilient. So they resist it, and they're also resilient.
Got to jump in. I'm so sorry. We're out of time. The new book by Judy Y. Chu is called When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Judy, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.